Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined today by Dr. Olin Nedeberg. He's a physician, emergency physician, but unlike many of us who have spots within the United States and debating over where we're going to be doing our practices and things like that, he has chosen as missionary work with his wife, Danae, to practice in the country of Chad. In fact, Olin is the medical director for the, I think he's told me Barry, Beret.
Yep.
Adventist Hospital. Actually, Hospital Adventiste de Beret. That's, that's if you want to look at it formally. And that is probably completely incorrect. And so if you're French, I apologize. But part of the Chad mission, he's actually been there about 8.5 years. He has become a little bit of a hero entity among emergency physicians on EM Docs and elsewhere, secondary to his work. And unlike here in the United States, where we are very relatively constrained in terms of our practice, Olin and his wife, Danae, are actually the chief cooks and bottle washers of the entire outfit over there in Beret and at the Beret Hospital. And it's pretty pretty amazing. And so I wanted to bring him here. I've been trying to get him onto the front line to chit-chat about that, the challenge being that apparently internet access where he is in Chad is only slightly better than where I am here in rural Kentucky. And so we finally got him here. He's in the United States for a couple of weeks, speaking at a conference last week. And so we wanted to get him here today. So Olin, thanks for joining us on the front line.
It's a pleasure.
So give us a little background. How did this all happen? I mean, you really kind of started off in Loma Linda with med school. That's where you met your wife and all of those things. How did this whole process kind of come to fruition?
Well, I love talking and telling stories, but I'll try to keep it under an hour here. I finished college and had no idea what to do with life. So I spent 6 months in Korea, 6 months in Africa. And a buddy of mine who was already in Africa wanted to go see what a hospital is like. So we spent 5 weeks in a hospital there in Africa. And I decided I wanted to go to medical school. So came back to America, took the MCAT, did medical school, and found a girl who was just as foolish as I am. And we got married and we did what we always wanted to do, which is go back to Africa and try to help.
And so this is now 8.5 years later. Tell me, as you trained in the United States, as I mentioned, you and your wife met at Loma Linda, and then you go over to Chad. Tell me about that first experience as you see where you're going to be working, the environment of which you're going to be working, and really how things kicked off.
Oh, man. It was a rough start, to be honest. We went with a one-year-old baby, and my wife was pregnant. She hates being pregnant, but she was pregnant anyways. And we got there, and of course, my wife is an OBGYN, and the statistics for Chad and maternal infant mortality is atrocious. So, of course, we go to save the world. And out of the first 6 deliveries that she had in the first few days there, 5 dead babies, 5 out of 6. It was brutal. So she's calling me up. I'm trying to resuscitate these babies, and I'll keep them alive for a few hours, but they always end up fading out. And so it was a real brutal introduction. Fortunately, we've gotten better since then. But, you know, a lot of what we practice in America is totally not applicable there. And a lot of what I do there, I mean, most of what I do there is totally not applicable in America either. It's all tropical medicine. The first 6 months I was there in Chad, I read more than I read in 3 years of residency, just trying to figure out everything I had to know. It was a pretty brutal start.
Well, you mentioned it. You kind of got into it. Tell me some of those things that here in the United States that you take for granted. I mean, obviously, maternal fetal medicine, the OBGYN aspect of things is clearly something where, you know, we're pretty spoiled in terms of expecting the baby to be okay. Tell me some of those things that when you got there, like, man, if they only knew in the United States, or I wish I had this from the United States, or those types of things that you tend to take for granted.
You know, I think my wife misses mostly Taco Bell. But from the hospital side, the medical stuff that we miss, you know, we have an ultrasound machine, and I was fortunate that I was trained at a time when ultrasound was just becoming something taught to all residents. So I had a pretty good training in that. We have no x-ray, let alone, you know, CAT scan, MRI. There are a couple machines in the country, but they're all broken at this moment. You know, fancy labs like potassium, creatinine, those are things that we don't have. So you really develop your clinical skills, but there are reasons we have those tests, because you can't figure out all that stuff just by clinical skills. So sometimes we miss, sometimes it's trial and error. But certainly we do our best. Medications we miss. One of the things I miss most as an ER doctor, you know, I don't have colleagues. You know, my OB wife is awesome, but there's a lot of specialties I can't bounce ideas off of. And the big thing is I don't have an ICU. So, you know, a person comes in coding, I code them, you know, even if I bring them back, you know, where am I going to put them without an ICU? And there's been 5 or 6 times where I've intubated somebody, I've brought them back to life, and I don't have a nurse to spare at night. I can't do it myself. So I'll have family bag the patient all night long. And invariably, the patient dies. And it may or may not have something to do with the family. But I don't want to leave the family, you know, thinking that they killed their patient, whatever. So unless it's the OR, unless it's a newborn, unless I have a good solid plan for soon extubation, you know, I intubate in the OR several times a year, but most of the time I'm not even doing those, you know, things that we wouldn't even consider to be heroic measures in America. The run-of-the-mill ER stuff, I'm not even doing that. And it's a pity because time and time again you say, you know, this is somebody that I'm 95% sure would live in America. We have the resources. But there we just can't do it. And that kind of gets to us. We do know that we're doing the best with what we have. So we have that slight peace of mind. But at the end of the day, like, we're just beating ourselves up because we had the dumb luck to be born in America where we have all these resources. And we're not better. I mean, we don't merit it. It's just the luck of the draw. And somebody else was born somewhere else where they never have the chance. And then that does kind of wear on us after a while.
And is there any frustration with that dichotomy that you just talked about when you're sitting there in front of a family and you know that this little blue marble that we live on is not relatively very big, and yet there's so much difference and that there is solutions to these folks somewhere. They just, and as you mentioned, the luck of the draw, that they don't have access to this and the tools that, you know, you could use to either save a life or dig down a little bit deeper to get a little bit more exactness in diagnosis, but even that support structure. How do you cope with sitting in front of somebody knowing that elsewhere in the world and not that far away, honestly, there's places in Africa, especially getting into Europe and Asia as well, that have outcomes that are going to be multiplicative better. Sitting in front of them and in front of these patients, knowing that you're doing everything that you can and yet just location, location, location.
Yeah, you hit on a lot of great points there. And like you said, Africa is a big place. And there are places like Senegal, West Africa, East Africa, and Kenya, Tanzania. You get down to South Africa. There's a lot of places that are really advanced medically and in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, Chad is a little behind the game in that way. But it seemed to be with me, the frustrations of being limited were kind of biphasic. When I first got there, yeah, it frustrated me to bits. And then I kind of learned to accept it. And now 8.5 years out, the things that I had initially gotten over and accepted, now those frustrations just build and build and build. Whereas after I'd been there for a year or two, they were minor nuisances. Now it just kind of gets to me. And, you know, as doctors, we're mostly type A. And a lot of doctors come to a place like Chad. They get so frustrated because they want to give the best quality care. And they're not able to step back and say, you know what, I'm doing the best with what I have. And I'm helping people. And a lot of American doctors burn out. They can't handle that. They got to come back to the States. And a lot of us also, we get too complacent. We accept more than we should. And really, we should be working harder to make the place better. It's a challenge that we face day in and day out. It's rare. It's extremely rare that I see a patient, have a patient in Africa, and I treat them there in Africa exactly the same way that I would treat them in America. Because we're just limited.
You and your wife, because we talked about it before we started recording, you know, here in the States, we have very siloed practices of medicine. Your wife, Danae, would be OBGYN, and that's what she would be, OBGYN. And you would be emergency medicine inside the emergency department, maybe some responses every once in a while to elsewhere in the hospital. But from what you're telling me, this is your board certification. It's just that initial training, but there you are. Legitimately, and I like to say that emergency physicians in the States are the jack of all trades, but we are a very narrow focused jack. And you guys are doing it all.
You know, and like you said, as emergency physicians, we are jack of all trades, master of one. We're really good at what we do. But you know, we're the second best cardiologists. We're the second best OBGYNs. We're the second best of all these other things. which really was a decent specialty for me to choose to go to Africa. Probably surgery would be more useful where we are. Stuff like OBGYN is really important where we are. But, you know, I feel like I have a good solid background, so I can do internal medicine. I can do pediatrics. I can do the ultrasound. I can go in and I can do anesthesia. And yeah, sure, I've learned a little bit of surgery, but my wife is so great, I really haven't had to learn too much of that. But yeah, we don't really have anybody to refer to. We're a small district hospital. We're 25 miles from the nearest pavement. Our region of 1 million people, there is no power grid. Some people might have their own private generators, but there's no city water. There's none of those services at all. And technically, we're supposed to refer to a regional hospital. The regional hospital refers to the national referral hospital. But in practicality, the National Referral Hospital refers patients to us, I mean, all the time, every year, every month. And they have to come down. They spend 10, 12 hours on a bus, on a motorcycle to get to us. And we're oftentimes the best option. I mean, there are some fantastic Chadian doctors. They really, really, really care about their patients. They want to be excellent. But they'll go through medical school, and all of medical school, they won't have a cadaver. They won't have a textbook. They won't have a clinical attending to teach them. So they're really limited. And we've been blessed, I mean, just by the dumb luck to be Americans, we've been blessed by having excellent medical education. And so now we're trying to give that great care with whatever limitations we have. We've also really moved recently into training local people, training local nurses, training local doctors. And that's what gets us excited, because that's the future. That's how you can really reach out and help more than one patient at a time, is to teach doctors so that they can go out and help.
The United States, we currently, according to a 2014 World Health Organization survey, U.S. Here in the United States had 24.5 physicians per 10,000 patients. What kind of numbers are you looking at? I wouldn't expect you to have the exact number sitting on the top of your head, but what is that access? Here in the United States, you're going to trip over a doctor every two or three blocks. Not as often as the one block you're going to trip over a lawyer, but every couple of blocks, you're going to get a physician. You're going to trip over at least one of them. There in Chad, you mentioned that you're so many miles from pavement. What is the access to healthcare in the area in which you work and in Chad in general?
Yeah, that's a huge limiting factor. I do actually know the number. So you mentioned, I think it was 24 for America in 2014. It was 2008 or 2009. It's a little bit older number, but in Chad, it was 0.2. So 0.2 physicians per 10,000 people. I believe that number has gone up because they just started putting like 170 students a year through medical school. But again, they're not getting trained. They don't have the chance. The ones that are amazing, that are brilliant, that work their tails off, that want to give high quality, compassionate care to patients, nobody's there to teach them. So even that point too is a challenge. Most Chadians never see a doctor in their life. They go to health centers, and there are extremely few health centers that have doctors. Most of them have nurses. Some of them are even staffed by people that never have any medical training at all. They're not even nurses. And so it's a major, major challenge. And when I see a patient, unless I have fact otherwise, I have to assume that patient has never seen a doctor before and that they're never going to see a doctor again. So, I mean, it'd start from scratch and try to figure out what they're going to need for the rest of their life. So, you know, patients come in. 100% of my patients, I deworm them no matter what their symptoms are. I give them warm medicine. I give them albendazole, praziquantel. It's definitely a challenge. It's a completely different mindset. And especially as emergency physicians, you know, our job is to make sure that there's no threat to their permanent health going on right now. And if there is, we need to fix it. And otherwise, they can go follow up with their physician. We can plug them into the system. We can admit them to the hospital where people can consult on them. Where we are, it's us and it's only us. We have nobody to refer to. There's no outpatient doctor to refer to. If I'm admitting to the hospitalist, that's a drag because I'm the hospitalist too. So it is definitely the kind of the antithesis to what we enjoy as emergency physicians in America.
If you're doing the math in your head, don't worry about it. We already did it. So that 2008 number compared to the 2014 number here in the United States is 0.8 or 0.8 of 1% of the physician access that we experience here in the United States. And so you could imagine that the sheer numbers or lack thereof of access experience, and that really blows my mind. If somebody, you know, potentially we grow up our entire early parts of our lives at least seeing the physician once or twice a year, and the expectation then that once you hit about 45 or 50 years old, you're seeing a doctor, it seems like every couple of days. So I took a trip to Ecuador a mission trip to Ecuador and was providing care. And it was internal medicine pediatrics that were there, and they needed somebody that could do some internal medicine as well as some emergency medicine procedures type stuff. So they gave me a ring and went down there, and there was stuff that would come in. And of course, just what you talked about, the deworming medications and things like that. But there was so much where you said, you know, we've got treatments for this, but within, I can give you a month, but after a month that you don't have access after that. So what is that point other than making me feel better about myself of giving somebody 1 month of medication to help with reflux and gastritis versus the fact that following that, the access just isn't there? Do you face any of that where you're like, you know what, there is stuff. We may even have access to some of that stuff, but just the lack of longitudinal care makes it challenging for us to consider this and going with something that may be either a next best step or foregoing it altogether.
That's absolutely a daily challenge. I was saying, you know, I discharge a patient and I have them follow up with their primary care doctor, and that's me. So they got to come back to find me at the hospital. There is nobody else unless it's a woman of reproductive age and I can try to pawn it off on my wife for some reason. But that is, yeah, that's definitely a challenge. You think about chronic disease like hypertension, diabetes. It's a challenge to afford the daily medicine for the rest of their lives. And the mentality is very much so, I have an illness, I take a medicine, and I'm healed. So it's a real challenge to convince hypertensive patients, diabetic patients, et cetera, that no, these are medicines you have to take for the rest of your life. And so we do quite a bit of, I don't know, lifestyle medicine, which is, again, nothing that ER doc, well, we do a little bit, but most emergency physicians in America aren't doing a lot of lifestyle medicine, you know, counseling on diet and exercise and whatever else to control your diabetes, control your hypertension. But we do a bit of that just because it's the only choice a whole bunch of our patients have. Of course, running a hospital, I have to be the administrator and think of the bottom line. That doesn't pay anything in Chad, but it is the better thing for our patients. So we do spend a lot of time doing that. Talking about medicines, and yeah, I can help you this month, but not the next. We have a lot of really well-intentioned people that they have some leftover medicines from their practice or whatever. Or, you know, their great aunt died, and so they've got some metoprolol or something that they want to send me. And that's great. And I say yes, and I take it and I use it. But then the fact is that month of metoprolol runs out, and now I've got to figure out something else to do with them because we don't have metoprolol in the country. So what are we going to do? And, you know, we get those medicines. We give them away for free. It is a way to get some free medicine into our patients. But it is hard to turn that into good long-term care.
What are the big themes that you see? United States life expectancy is 78.69 years as of 2016. Chad, where you are working, not where you currently are, but where you are working and will return here shortly, is 52.9 years. You know, so you're probably not going to be seeing that, you know, those five or six in a row 95-year-olds coming in with hip fractures and issues associated with falls on NOAC-based medications. What are the big themes and things that you see that really kind of predominate your practice? For me, it's going to be abdominal pain, chest pain, and of course, elderly comorbid condition-related issues. What do you see, and what does that look like in your quote-unquote emergency department/hospital?
So our emergency department, we do occasionally get bona fide emergency patients, but again, I'm limited as to what I can do. It's more of a walk-in clinic, maybe an urgent care. So yeah, people are coming in for, I don't want to say chronic disease, but stuff they've been suffering with for several days. Probably the most impactful disease that I see is malaria. Honestly, if we could cure malaria, I could just about be out of a job. Malaria is absolutely brutal in lots of the developing world, but where we are in Chad, it's just the scourge of everything. And you know, businesses, industry, they can't develop because people are always getting malaria. So how do you do that when your employees are always sick or their kids are sick or so-and-so died? And of course, in our culture, even if it's a shoestring relative, if a family member dies, you have to go for a week to go sit with the family. And malaria, man, that's the bane of my existence over there. That's got to be my number one. Typhoid is high on that list. Amoebas, Giardia, and Amoeba histolytica. I'm seeing those every day. Those are probably the big ones, just major infectious disease.
What's interesting is everything that you've mentioned is some sort of basically an infectious-based disease process where We're dealing a lot with the chronic conditions of age. It really is kind of amazing. So you mentioned a lot of things that you do, and clearly not like my day. Like later today, I'm going to go into my emergency department at Baptist Health, and I'm going to start at 4 o'clock, and I'm going to pick up as many patients I can. At 2 o'clock, I walk out of the hospital. I don't know what happens after I admit them to the hospital. I don't do anything with them in the floor unless they decide to have a rest or whatever in the CT scanner. So it's a very narrow focus. Give me an idea, Ola Nettaberg's daily routine. Kind of walk me through the process of your days practicing in CHED.
Now, I got to be honest, about a year ago, we got another American doctor, and we got another one this year. And my mother-in-law left the country, which means I do a lot of stay-at-home dad stuff. So I'm, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours a day in the hospital now. The rest of it is trying to homeschool and put some food on the table. But prior to that, at least my average day was probably going at 7 o'clock. We have worship every day. We're a Christian hospital. We have worship every day at 7 o'clock. Then we're trying to do some teaching with the staff from 7:30 to 8:30 or 9. Then my typical day was round on pediatrics, round on medicine, help out with any anesthesia in the OR if they're young, if they're old, if they're comorbid, if they're pregnant. I try to go help out with the anesthesia that they do. Help out with any ultrasounds or train. I spent 6 months of my life over there training ultrasound guys so that they can do most of it. I just have to go help when they get stuck. And then unfortunately, boy, probably the last 5 to 6 years, a lot of my job is administration, which is a total drag. I hate it, but it's either that or make my wife do it, and she hates it more than I do. So for peace in the home, I am stuck with a lot of signing papers.
So for Mother's Day, you show her the last spreadsheet that you did and say, "Happy Mother's Day, honey."
She's a bit more of a romantic than that. But yeah, and also a lot of my day. So as we used to do a lot of consults on patients in the office. So nurses are in the emergency department. Nurses consult every patient that comes in. And if it's something outside of what the nurse can do, they send it to us to see it. And we used to see them in our office, but so few of our patients actually speak French that we always need a translator. So we just started doing all the consults in the prep room of the OR, which isn't the best for hygiene, but it is the way to be able to quickly grab the instruments we need, to quickly grab somebody who can translate into whatever language it is the patient speaks, and get stuff done. And our workload is highly seasonably dependent. Right now, from May to September, maybe even October, we aren't really that busy. We're seeing maybe 30, 40, 50 patients a day. But you know, you come in December, January, February, we're running around like crazy people. And 7 a.m. to 7, 8 p.m. is an average day, 5 to 6 days a week. And we'll just be cranking out consults in the prep room of the OR all day long. And the cool stuff is, I mean, our pathology is awesome. I love our pathology. American pathology is going to be boring. What we see is we see that those end stage pictures that are in the textbooks that we never see in real life because people seek out care earlier. And so they get things taken care of a lot earlier. So my day-to-day pathology, yeah, it's malaria, malaria, malaria. Oh my goodness, what is that tumor? And then more malaria. And then I do love the puzzling, trying to figure it out. I'm certainly no internist at heart. I don't enjoy that quite degree of really cranking through the minutiae of pathophysiology. But being able to see this crazy stuff that people have had for months or years, that they delayed seeking care, they've gone to health centers, other hospitals before they get to us, and then being able to figure out the problem, I do really enjoy that. And so from a pathophysiological standpoint, the stuff we get to see is just incredible. In fact, volunteers that come, I guarantee every volunteer that comes that we can find at least one thing a day that they've never seen before in their careers. And I don't think I've missed out on that promise yet. I think I've still made good on that one. Yeah, our pathology is just so much, well, I hate to say fun. It's fun for us. It's extra fun when it's actually something that we can fix.
It's medical professional fun, interesting type stuff. You know, that's the lay public doesn't jive with our kind of morbid curiosity and like interesting pathology. But that's, you know, you post stuff, kind of demonstrate things that you're seeing, and other doctors say, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe that." You know, it's actually what you're talking about is stuff we see and hear of in books, but never will actually see in clinical practice. And so it really is amazing. And when I was in med school, we had several people that would go to Africa for rotations, especially fourth year rotations. What's your feeling on that importance and role of U.S. physicians in general, but even potentially you know, something, an addition to emergency medicine training of coming to a place, not necessarily has to be Chad, but I mean, I'm sure you'd be pretty cool with that, is coming and experiencing that type of medicine where the history and the physical exam is still really what's going to get the best answer that you're going to get, the limitation of resources, and really having to have the ultimate, the buck stops here. You have to figure it out yourself because the next option may be, you know, hours, if not days away.
Yeah, or flat out impossible. I mean, most of my patients can't afford to travel up to the Capitol to get to the referral hospital. That may or may not just send them right back down to me anyways. But it's extraordinarily rare that we refuse a volunteer. And, you know, yeah, we're a Christian hospital, but we've taken all manners of Christianity. We've had Muslim volunteers. We've had Jewish volunteers. We've had the whole atheist, agnostic, apathetic run of it. We take everybody. And everybody wants to come and help. And before they show up, we try to temper their expectations a little bit. You know, particularly a place like Chad, if you don't speak French, if you don't speak Arabic, there's only so much genuine help you can provide. Unless if you're a surgeon, yeah, I can throw you in the OR, you can do a physical exam, and then you can operate. But otherwise, it's cultural stuff. It's knowing tropical medicine. It is challenging. So yeah, you're going to cost me some time and effort when you come to help. But that's okay, because we think it's great for the person, because the person, I mean, it just blows their mind. People come in the first few days, they're just walking around shell-shocked at what we see. But then you see the light switch on in their eyes, and they get to see the beauty of it. And yeah, there's no reason to come to Chad as a tourist. It's an ugly place, but the people are beautiful. The people are just amazing. The culture is beautiful. It's completely different from American culture. If you stay long enough, it'll drive you insane. But it really is beautiful when you see the differences and how they care for certain things. And the other thing, it does benefit us personally, myself and my wife, because we have some camaraderie. We have somebody coming to remind us that we're not alone. We have somebody medically that we can bounce some ideas off of. We have somebody that maybe brings some skill that we don't have, some knowledge that we don't have. You know, we haven't practiced in America now for 9 years. You know, we can read articles, but when you read articles, you don't really know what's going into practice. And so there are a lot of benefits for Danae and for myself when we have other doctors come. Even when you have medical students come, residents come, college students, non-medical people, just to be able to show off what we do. Because yeah, we're burned out, but we're still very proud of what's going on. We're still very passionate about providing excellent care, the best care we can in the place where we are. And we love sharing that with people. We really get a joy out of sharing that with people.
I think it would be a fantastic experience. I mean, there's wonderful experiences all over the world. And if you've never, as physicians, experienced another part of the world, especially a third world or developing type environment where, you know, we take what we have for granted, you know, and there it is honest joy and gratitude and for anything that you provide and that anything you can do for folks. With Olin and Danae, they've got their blog. It's missionarydoctors.blogspot.com. Olin and Danae, Life Under the Mango Trees. So you can keep up with some of that. But also, if you're an emergency physician on EM Docs, keeping up with some of the things that he experiences and sees and really some amazing things that they're doing in Chad. And missionary physicians and physicians all over the world doing similar type stuff. And that's one kind of final question for you. How has social media and the connection of social media with physicians around the world been able to really change your practice in terms of, you know, really real-time consults at any given hour and any given day?
So it was 2013 when I first brought an iPhone back to Chad and plugged it in and realized, hey, I can actually get on Facebook. And then EM Docs came along, and it's really given us a sense that we're not alone. Whereas before we felt completely isolated, now we're not alone. There's camaraderie. There's people that can tap into, you know, there's 23,000 doctors on EM Doctors. And it's not just emergency medicine. Those are folks that then have friends, spouses, colleagues in other fields that they can tap into and ask questions. And yeah, being able to get those real-time consults, it's prevented us from doing a lot of harm to patients. It's helped us to really help patients. Having that network on Facebook, it seems silly and trite, but it is not. I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration whatsoever to say that network is helping us save lives. We're two doctors out there without all kinds of specialization, without all kinds of resources to look stuff up. And we have a social network of people that can bail us out and that are committed to helping us. That's a huge thing.
Fantastic program. And how can folks, if they have questions, especially if interest in coming over and maybe even committing longer term to Chad, actually for us, you can listen to some of our podcasts that we have talking about the evolution of emergency medicine residencies and programs. in Africa in general, the giant continent with many countries that had very little emergency medicine residencies and programs, and now that is starting to grow as well. So we have a couple of those podcasts that you can listen to talking about that. And Olin, if somebody wants to potentially look further, has questions for you, even potentially just supporting from a financial or a consultant type standpoint, how can folks get in touch with you?
For donations is they're always encouraged. From our website that you mentioned, there is a link to go to a group named AHI, Adventist Health International. They're the NGO that manage our hospital. And help us be able to get some supplies. We're actually shipping a container later this year of medical equipment so that we can start the first ICU, although it's going to be a lot to train nurses to know how to run it. So if people want to come out and hang out with us, or if people have questions, if they're on EM Docs, they can find us on Facebook. Even if they're not on EM Docs, they can find us on Facebook, send us a message. I don't think our email is linked on the blog. I'm not sure, it might be. But there are ways to get a hold of us. Facebook is probably the easiest for most people.
Fantastic. I appreciate your time, and thank you for actually giving us a little bit of your visit here back to the States to chit-chat with us. And you are easy to find. There's a lot of information online, the blog as well. If you look up Olin or Danae or both, it's going to be one of the top searches on Google. So it was very easy for me to find, and I was not doing anything especially technical in typing in the names in Google. Also on Facebook, you know, a place where a lot of times we feel like we go for, you know, some support, some camaraderie, some friends, some sharing stupid memes and things like that. You know, occasionally you'll find true gems and nuggets of greatness that you kind of see and really are inspired in terms of what they're doing around the world and around other areas for people who are relatively otherwise underserved. So Dr. Netberg, thank you for joining us here on the Frontline.
We love what we do, and we love to share it.
And as for me, you can contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. We are also on Facebook, ASAP Frontline, and then at Everyday Med on Twitter. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and you've been listening to some ASAP Frontline.